Welcome, everybody. PersonalGrowth.net presents Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining. Today is part three of the three-part series on happiness. And the focus today is on interventions, actual practical kinds of ways of bringing happiness into our lives. And I'm going to focus on a number of practical kinds of recommendations, some of which will be expanded in later meetings that we'll have when we talk about gratitude and forgiveness, but that'll get a much broader kind of coverage. The first component I'm going to talk about is one that's not all that surprising, but it's one that many people think really you're either born with or not born with, but the reality is it could be cultivated. And that's the component of happiness that's related to the almost biologically driven mindset to see the glass of water as half full as opposed to half empty, sort of innate optimism. We all know that there are people that we know who are just seem to be born optimists. Right from the get-go, they seem to be the kind of people who have a gift for always looking at the bright side of things. I remember hearing a lecture from a very prominent psychologist in the field who said that his mother was the kind of woman that was such an optimist that on a day, if she would walk into a pile of dog waste, she would just grin and say, "Oh, thank God I'm wearing shoes." And I was once giving a lecture on a related topic, and one of the men in the audience shared with me a story that backed up his firm belief, and one that I can really relate to, about how optimism is something that some people just seem to have a almost genetic predisposition for. And in fact, there is research showing that a certain level of the gift of optimism does come from a predisposition. But we'll see as I go on that could be cultivated. Tell me the story. He said that his mother was one of the youngest survivors of Auschwitz, of the concentration camp. And he said that somehow she managed to look a little bit older than her age, and even though she was pre-adolescent when she went through the horrible experience of being among those lucky minority that were selected not to go to the gas chambers but to go to the side of the camp where you would be subjected to horrible torture and working under worse than slave labor conditions, she described to him that horrible day where she was selected to go into the work camp section of Auschwitz. And she said she saw the scene that's been described many, many times of the tattoos being inscribed on a concentration camp inmates' arms. I grew up in a neighborhood where there were many, many concentration camp survivors who were the parents of my friends. And I remember thinking that was almost the norm, that that's parents had tattoos with numbers etched on their arm. But she, as this young girl, looked at the scene of the tattooing, and she said to herself, you know, I'm going to live a very, very long life. And she was somewhat vain. She said, you know, I want to have, she said to herself, the best-looking tattoo I possibly can. And she looked at the various lines of the hundreds and maybe thousands of people waiting online, and she joined the longest line, saying to herself that if I'm going to have this tattoo for my very long life, the longest line probably has at the head of it the tattoo artist who is going to give the best-looking, most meticulous kind of tattoo. And the man went on to tell me that his mother is alive to this day, and he said, if I ever get a chance to meet her, he'll show me that her tattoo is something that to this day she's very proud of because it's meticulous. And the tattoo artist was very careful to take pride in his work. Now, that's almost a bizarre story, but it shows how even in the shadow of death, in one of the most horrible places in the history of humanity, there still could be a spark of optimism that gets us through. And in fact, there's all kinds of interesting both research and anecdotes that show about the benefits of cultivating an optimistic style. Dr. Seligman, in his book called Learned Optimism, where he talks about how you could cultivate a style of optimism, tells a story about a politician in a study done in American politics, where they found that when Dr. Seligman took a group of his graduate students at the University of Pennsylvania and he had them analyze every victory speech given by the winner of the Republican presidential nomination convention and of the Democratic nomination over the last 100 years. And he stripped it of the names so that his graduate students didn't know whose speech they were reading. And he had them read the speeches, just coding it for how many optimistic and positive remarks were given versus how many negative remarks were given. And it turned out that the number of optimistic, hopeful responses were more predictive of who would win the presidential election than were the most trusted and reliable polls. And isn't that true? Isn't it true that one wants to believe in and in a sense vote for the people that you come in contact with who are optimists? It's just fun to be around optimists. It kind of energizes you. And it turns out that optimism is very much one of the core ingredients of happiness. One can learn to cultivate, and I'd recommend Dr. Seligman's book, a view of day-to-day events where you really, by believing that everything will work out, it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it predisposes you to constructive and productive kinds of action. If you believe that things won't work out, then failure is very likely going to ensue. If you look at every challenge as something that in turn energizes you and propels you to action, it becomes a whole energizing kind of process that can lead to success. The research shows that people who handle the setbacks in their lives and the mistakes in their lives as a challenge rather than as a threat, as feedback rather than a setback, are able to get through even the worst challenges of life in a way that's far more productive. And they, in turn, will deal with the ongoing daily stresses, little daily hassles. You can't go through life without hassles, in a way that doesn't bring them down and in a way that's associated with happiness rather than with sadness. The general research on optimism shows us that people who cultivate this kind of cognitive style are, in a way that's not at all surprising, is the studies show they're more likely to persevere in the face of difficulty. They're more likely to handle daily stressors with active and more effective coping mechanisms. And they're even able to handle life transitions and illness better. And the popularity is not only in the area of winning elections, but in general, they have more friends and are more likely to be successful in work and social settings. So that's the first point. It's almost like a throwaway point because it's almost begging the question, how does one really change a predisposition? If you're predisposed to see the glass of water as half empty, how do you work on it? And it's a matter of catching yourself, catching the thoughts, and developing the habit of attention to the positive as opposed to the negative. And again, it's beyond the scope of this talk to go into tremendous detail about cultivating optimism, but Dr. Seligman's book is a classic in the field. Again, it's called Learned Optimism, and his book on children called The Optimistic Child actually shows, very interestingly, that in children, if parents can learn to cultivate optimism in a child who's prone to pessimism and depression, he showed in a series of studies in suburban Pennsylvania that he's actually able to lower their risk for depression and increase their chances of living a more happy, successful, and optimistic life. And he goes into tremendous detail on how to raise optimistic children. Again, the name of the book is Optimistic Child. The next practical recommendation I want to give is that of the power of goal setting. The power that I alluded to in our last talk, where I quoted the passage from Proverbs, "Be'ein chazon yifara'am," which is translated as "without vision, we sort of dwindle away." Vision and goals, as I said in our last meeting, is something that connects us to the straight line of purpose and is clearly associated with happiness. What's some of the research on this? It turns out that in a series of studies done by Dr. King and some other psychologists, they found that a deceptively simple psychological exercise actually raised happiness levels. And it's a fascinating, fascinating exercise. He asked people to spend 20 minutes a day on 4 consecutive days writing down a description of their best possible future selves. So the exercise basically went like this. It says that you sit down, you lock yourself in a room, and here's the actual directions. And I'm quoting verbatim. You imagine yourself in the future after everything has gone as well as it possibly could. You've worked hard and succeeded at accomplishing all of your life goals. And think of this as the realization of your life's dreams and of your own best potentials. And then basically what you're asked to do is to visualize the best possible future for yourself in various areas of your life, trying to imagine for yourself what your life would be like if all of your dreams came true. And somehow, what would happen if you actually got in touch in a very specific way that you could almost hold on to the reality of realizing your dreams? And the strangest thing happens. When you do this just 20 minutes a day for 4 days in a row, getting in touch with these goals, your happiness levels go up. Your sense of physical kind of health goes up, and these feelings actually are sustained for several months. It doesn't permanently transform you, but it actually isn't just an ephemeral passing kind of feeling. And that's actually, to me, quite fascinating, because in a way it doesn't make sense when you just look at it. Why is it that fantasizing about one's future and getting in touch with long-term goals and the best possible kind of self and outcomes should have that kind of powerful effect? And why on happiness? But again, it goes back to what I was talking about from the Jewish thinking standpoint in our last meeting, which is when we're connected to the straight line of who we are and who we're supposed to be, and we realize our potential in that way, then the natural outcome is going to be the simcha. Remember, is the simcha of shamoach, of connecting ourselves and our minds to a true and authentic self rather than to false kinds of dreams that are not really based on the essence of who we really are. That's the second main thought I wanted to talk about, which is basically the sense of purpose, structure, and control that comes with goal setting. And, you know, it's interesting. I was once talking to a colleague who told me, you know something, if you see a happy person walking down the street and you just start talking to them, you'll almost certainly find a project behind the happiness. Find a happy person and you'll find a project. And sometimes I'll do a little experiment with myself and I'll try to see, when I find somebody who's unusually happy, and I'll try to see what is it that's really keeping them going in terms of what's number one on their mattering map. And very often I'll find that there really is a clear sense of purpose and meaning in their lives. And they have those goals. It may be writing a book. It may be a project, a charity project. It may be some kind of connection to the three Fs of family, friends, and faith. And somehow, when you have that magic combination of a practical focus on personal goals that connects them to the three Fs of funds, friends, and faith, that's when you start to see that kind of glow that you could almost pick at the person who has that kind of sense of purpose and organization and structure to the meaning in their lives. Now, this is an important piece that I think needs to be looked at. What kind of goal is most likely to be related to happiness? Because it turns out that obviously if your goal is, let's say, I don't know, to some kind of ephemeral, materialistic goal, that's not necessarily going to do it, as we spoke about in the first lecture when we looked at the connection between materialistic goals and long-term happy outcomes. But basically, there's three characteristics of goals, psychological research tells us, that are most likely to be related to happiness. One is goals that are coming from not the dreams of others being placed on us, but rather goals that are coming from our inner souls, an inner sense of purpose. There's a fascinating passage in the Torah where Jacob is blessing his children. And the use of language in the Torah in that section is Ish Asher Kafi Berchaso Beirach Osam, meaning each child was blessed in a unique way. And actually, if you look at the blessings are kind of strange because they're less blessings than dead-on descriptions of the personalities and essence of each of his children. And Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, a well-known rabbi of the 19th century, said that what's underneath that is that the essence of happiness is when a parent really gets and validates the essence of a child. And a later rabbi who was more active in the first part of the 1900s, Rabbi Yeruchim Levavitz, kind of expands on this thought, and he explains the following. And I think it's an incredibly powerful image in terms of this component of goal setting. Rabbi Levavitz says the following. He says, when a parent blesses a child, he or she is giving a blessing based on their own fantasies and their own dreams and their own wishes about what they want, based on their needs, not the needs of the child. He said it's as if one is taking a watering can and watering a patch of dirt that's totally fallow, that has no seeds in it. The total exercise in futility. He said, in order for a blessing to take hold, one has to have a match between the parents' dreams and the parents' aspirations and the parents' wishes for their child and the child's internal potential and what the child's wishes and goals and dreams are. That's an intrinsic goal. An intrinsic goal is the goal where we nourish and nurture in our children and in ourselves, goals that are coming from our innermost being and our innermost wishes. So those are the kind of goals most likely to be related to happiness. That's number one. And related to that is the concept that goals need to be coming from the expectations of, again, internal process, not the expectations of society. It really has to be, again, following one's innermost kinds of dreams. And all too often, people are chasing goals that are coming from either familial pressure or societal pressure. And then the final characteristic, so it's intrinsic, authentic, and it also has to be coming from a viewing the challenge that one is pursuing as a challenge rather than a threat. And what I mean by that is that when a goal that one is pursuing is one that one is almost threatened by it. You know, I don't know, let's say you're in the middle of pursuing a goal of trying to overcome, let's say trying to give up smoking. And your cravings for a cigarette is viewed as a threat and one that's associated with many previous attempts to give up smoking that have failed. And it's viewed as basically this incredible mountain that one is trying to climb and is not viewed as a challenge. You're not as likely to reach that goal, and it's not as likely to be associated with happiness, the research shows. Many of these thoughts are coming from a wonderful book that I wanted to recommend to you that I find probably the best book I've ever seen on practical interventions to promote happiness. It's called The How of Happiness, written by a very prominent expert in positive psychology, Dr. Lyubomirsky, Lyubomirsky. And she sort of puts together a set of recommendations, and some of what I'm speaking about is bouncing off of her compilation of the research on as she calls it, the how of happiness. And she has an important section in her book that I wanted to just talk about for a few minutes as we come to the end of today's section. And something that she calls savoring life, very interesting kind of concept, because it's very tied to the next topic that I wanted to focus on, which is our next session, which is the topic of gratitude, which is very tied to happiness. But it's a good bridge between the how of happiness and moving on to an in-depth understanding of what secular and Jewish thinking is on gratitude. Savoring life, she said, is nourishing the ability to intensify and prolong our enjoyment. She says all too often people have a natural tendency to kind of postpone our happiness, to say, well, look, you know, our life at certain stages is about tomorrow, not about today. It's about putting off all too often, you know, we focus on, okay, first school and then reaching our goals in terms of getting whatever degree we need to be able to work or mastering our skills for our jobs. And there's always a belief that our ultimate happiness lies tomorrow. It lies in perhaps our retirement or the day that'll come by that maybe we'll be able to really savor or appreciate life more. And unfortunately, as we know, is that it's very hard to live in the present and to develop that sense of mindfulness. It's a muscle that we almost have to build up by consciously developing the habit of attention that I'm going to talk about when I talk about gratitude. What's pointed out by psychologists on the literature on savoring is that the best way to understand it is, you know, that feeling you have when an illness disappears. Let's say you have the flu. And sometimes when you're in the middle of really feeling miserable, you have 104 temperature, and you have a headache, and you have fever, and you have chills. Remember that feeling like you think you're never going to feel better again, and you feel like, you know, you almost forget what it's like to feel healthy. even if it's a relatively brief illness. Then, when the illness disappears and your first really healthy day comes by, the fever is down, the headache is gone, and your energy is coming back, there's usually a brief period where you almost can really savor what it feels like to be healthy again. Very often, savoring is something that is a dish best served when we're recovering from some of the setbacks in life. You lose something like a favorite object, a favorite pen, or a watch that you love and maybe was given to you as a present when you were young, and you sort of give up hope on it, and then it's found. You're going through some old possessions, and you find the watch or the pen or the piece of jewelry that you thought was lost forever. So you develop, again, a newfound appreciation for that object that we now can savor again. But even that only has a brief shelf life. And the research shows that happiness is increased when we learn to develop the capacity to savor, to just take a step back and really enjoy those special moments that are built in to a portion of every day. Now, by definition, you can't do it all day long. You just can't. It's just not the way we're built. But some of the strategies that Dr. Lyubomirsky talks about is just a few things that you could build into your life. You know, if you're used to taking a rushed shower, set the alarm clock for 5 minutes earlier and give yourself the gift of 5 minutes longer in the shower every morning. And just savor that feeling of solitude and of relaxation that comes with that extra 5 minutes. It could be a walk on a nice spring or summer day. It could be just taking the extra 5 or 10 minutes to savor a meal. And during that time, to just focus on the pleasure of the experience rather than rushing through it. It's very hard to do in a society that focuses on speed and the age of the BlackBerry and the age of constant access and the age of the cell phone. One of the really nice recommendations she makes is to maybe every once in a while take a camera where you go and take pictures of events that you're experiencing together with the family and learn how to savor with the camera by bringing back those memories. There's some fascinating research done by Dr. Gottman, an expert on marriages, and he talks about how if we nurture fondness and admiration for our spouse, you just take a minute or so as part of every day or at least 3-4 times a week, and remember what it was we fell in love with. Remember something nice they did for us. It's interesting. I had a therapy session this morning with a woman, wonderful woman. She's having some problems in her life. And she was talking in a very, very negative way about her husband, almost like thinking about all the negatives. And it's true. She has some very valid and legitimate points about all the ways that he was driving her crazy. But I just reminded her how just in a session we had about a month ago, she was talking about how he had helped her through a particularly difficult time in her life and how she was appreciating how he helped her through a difficult diagnosis and treatment for her illness, or how she appreciated how patient she was with their son when their son went through a tough time. And it was really interesting to see because she took a step back and she said, I forgot about that. And I saw a smile cross her face as I could almost see her savoring the fondness and admiration that she had almost forgotten about in terms of her relationship with her husband. And she said it really helped. There's a saying, I forget who says it, but it's, enjoy the little things, for one day you may look back and realize they were big things. Let me say that again. Enjoy the little things, for one day you may look back and realize that those were the big things. Let me get into some more specific recommendations given by Dr. Lyubomirsky. She talks about some research on something called positive reminiscing, which is basically you sit down, you make a list of happy memories and personal kind of memories that you just write down. Or it could even be taking out an old box of pictures or go on your computer collection of old pictures you haven't looked at for a while. And you then, let's say you're looking at the list of happy memories, you're going through those pictures. You just replay some of those moments in your life and savor them without analyzing. That's called positive reminiscing. It's setting aside a part. Again, not every day. She actually shows that sometimes when you do these kinds of exercises about once a week, it may even be more powerful. And she shows that when you systematically imagine and remember and replay and savor those happy memories through this process of positive reminiscing, your happiness levels increase. Again, it's simple. All of these exercises are simple, but they're actually enjoyable, and not only should they not be a chore, but they should be actually a treasure in terms of doing them. Here's the actual script used by the psychologist who did this study, a team led by a Dr. Bryant. Here's what they say. Here's the actual verbatim instructions. First, turn to your list of positive memories and choose one to reflect upon. Sit down, take a deep breath, relax, close your eyes, and begin to think about the memory. Allow images related to the memory to come to mind. Try to picture the events associated with this memory in your mind. Use your mind to imagine the memory. Let your mind wander freely through the details of the memory while you're imagining the memory. It seems, again, almost concrete, almost simplistic. But again, the art, I think, of nurturing happiness in your life really is simple. It's simple in the sense that when we connect to the things that matter, when we connect to our friends, to our family, to our faith, and to our goals, and get in touch with what really matters in life in a way that we overcome the grind and the hurried pace of life, and we give ourselves the gift of stepping back and looking at what matters, reconnecting to our dreams, reconnecting to our memories, and savoring what matters while developing the habit of attention to what we're grateful for, happiness is the natural outcome. So that finishes this session, and our next session will be to expand on this by looking in a much deeper way at what it is that psychology tells us about gratitude, some ways of building gratitude into our lives, and some really interesting kinds of Jewish perspectives on the pivotal role of gratitude in our lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Popovitz. Question for you. Why does visualizing the future help a person mentally?
I think it has to do with anything that gets us in touch with our authentic selves and where we're going. Anything that again, it goes back to that straight line, that connection to our true selves. If you remember the quote from Dr. Tatz that I spoke about in our last meeting, where we spoke about getting in touch with our journey, sort of like where that is. It's not about the destination. It's about the journey. And when we somehow get in touch with that in a very real and specific way, it's in essence the equivalent of blessing ourselves, of connecting to our essence. And anytime we connect to our essence, we're connecting to, I think, the wellsprings of happiness.
And is there a correlation between less densely populated areas with a slower pace of life and happiness?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's actually a book written that I have to, I must confess I never read. I only read reviews of the book. But it would probably answer your question. It's a great question. What is the happiness level of different countries as a as a function of the income level of the countries, of the pace of life in those countries? And they actually give in some research happiness levels, sort of like ratings of subjective well-being. They're just like countries have gross national product. They're talking about measuring countries in terms of their levels of subjective well-being. And I don't remember, I really should look into it, what it is that they find about rural, slow-paced areas, less densely populated areas, and happiness levels. Certainly impressionistically, I would say that when I leave New York City, I'm sitting here in an office in Manhattan, where we're so used to an incredibly fast pace of life, of rushing, that sometimes you'll just see the tourists stepping back and looking in a combination of fear and awe at the pace of the crowds here on the street. And then you have to wonder that when they go back to their slow pace, less pressured lives, do they appreciate it more, and do they connect to happiness more? But I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question. You could equally hypothesize that maybe those fast-paced people have a project, you know, and have a project that gives them meaning. So it's an interesting question. I'm going to have to look into that. I have to think about that. But I think the answer is there in the research. I have to look up that book.
Thank you. And is there a correlation between giving and happiness?
Absolutely, and that's something that I'm going to talk about in more detail at a future date, God willing. But I know that we touched on that a little bit. I believe the whole concept of required helpfulness, of getting our kids to pitch in. There's a higher rate of depression in kids who take and don't give. When you require the kids give, their happiness levels tend to go up, and that's also the case in terms of the psychology of charity. These givers and doers and volunteers are healthier and happier, and that's been documented in many, many studies.
Mm-hmm. And we discussed many mental things that affect happiness today. What is the how much does sleep, exercise, and nutrition factor into one's level of happiness?
Yeah, so clearly, clearly, all those things could play a role. You know, if you're sleep deprived, you're going to be more irritable. If you're dream deprived, you're going to be more irritable. We all know, that good feeling after aerobic exercise and after that kind of feeling of subjective well-being that washes over us. There's a very interesting, a very respected set of research done by Consumer Reports, but it was supervised actually by Dr. Seligman, I believe, of tens of thousands of people looking at what do people say helps them in combating various kinds of emotional problems, including depression and anxiety. So that's sort of the flip side of happiness. And it turns out that people who are depressed, when they rate what helps and what doesn't help, so obviously therapy could help and medication could help, but if I remember correctly, the top of the list, or if not number one, certainly towards the very top of the list in terms of treatment of depression is sustained aerobic exercise in terms of what people find to be really helpful. So yeah, that's another very important area.
Thank you. And Dr. Belkovitz, is there anything else you would like to add before we end today?
No, that's fine. I'm sure we could take questions at another time on this from people. But, so our next session will be the one on gratitude, God willing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining PersonalGrowth.net's Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom by Dr. David Pelkovitz, Ph.D.